Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with a prisoner release in Afghanistan and Guantanamo, where an American sergeant was swapped for five Taliban prisoners in a deal brokered by the Emir of Qatar. Vali Nasser, who served as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in the Obama administration and is the author of The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat, joins us to discuss whether this deal is a precursor for a wider deal in the works with the Taliban and the Haqqani network, who have been holding the American prisoner since 2009. Then we will speak with London-based writer and lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts, Mohammed Idris Ahmad, about indications the Obama administration may be re-engaging in Syria after years of ambivalence about intervening, during which time Islamist extremists have entrenched themselves in the rebellion against the Assad dictatorship to the point that they have been a boon to Bashar al-Assad, who has made a comeback while his country is being destroyed. We'll also look into Dr. Ahmad's article at the LA Review of Books, A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism, and why the left, who used to be champions of human rights and opposed to dictators, have more recently come to the defense of murderous regimes, often making excuses for Milosevic, Gaddafi, and Assad. Then finally, on the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre and the death of the student-led democratic movement in China, we will examine the Communist Party leadership's crackdown on any possible dissent by jailing prominent scholars and activists and warning Western journalists to stay away from the square in the coming days. Scott Kennedy, the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business at Indiana University, joins us to discuss the official amnesia in China over what happened 25 years ago and acrimonious exchanges between Defense Secretary Hagel and a Chinese general who denies China is destabilizing the region in disputes over islands in the South China Sea. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. His books include The Shia Revival, Democracy in Iran, and his latest, now in paperback, is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And what is I have a suspicion, Vali Nasser, that the release of these American sergeant and these five Taliban prisoners in this swap is perhaps a precursor for something more, because isn't that pretty much how these arrangements are made? The president's not going to deal seriously with the Taliban unless they release an American prisoner, and that would be, having done that, one assumes that they'll get onto a more important agenda.
Well, there is no doubt that this deal is an important first step, because there hasn't been a concrete deal around peace talks between the United States, Afghanistan, and the Taliban since 2009. However, since the United States is leaving Afghanistan, what might follow this prisoner exchange would have to be serious peace talks between the Afghan government, the new Afghan president, and the Taliban. I would suspect that the United States will play now a lesser role in the peace talks, largely because we no longer have a prisoner there to need to talk to the Taliban about. And since there is a plan for withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan at any rate, that the United States will probably play a less direct role in the peace talks, but it will encourage the Afghan government to do so more seriously.
Well, the United States apparently kept this deal from Hamid Karzai, Afghan's president, I presume because they don't trust him.
Well, it's absolutely correct, because Karzai has been talking from both sides of his mouth when it comes to peace talks with the Taliban. On the one hand, he was very eager for being allowed to talk to the Taliban. But on the other hand, every time the Qataris made a positive move with the Taliban, it was Karzai who undermined it. And for the United States, the release of Sergeant Bergdahl was very important, above and beyond just the peace talks. And they did not wish to give Karzai the ability to play politics with this. For instance, try to hold up the conclusion of this deal for something that he wants from the United States. And as a result, this ended up being a much more direct United States-Taliban deal than an Afghan peace process success story, which is usually the way in which we've promoted the reconciliation talks.
But what is the role of the Haqqani network in this? They've apparently been holding the American sergeant, and they are often referred to as the Taliban, but they are a distinct group and have been largely, as far as I understand, under the protection of the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI.
Well, the Haqqanis are probably one of the most vicious and also militarily effective components of the Taliban. They have a seat at the Taliban Shura, which is the council, the high council of the Taliban, but they are a separate unit within the Taliban. So they have their own operational and command structure. They have their own leadership. They have their own fighters. But they're a big piece of the Taliban, and they're the one that has carried out some of the worst attacks in Kabul, in the south, and it's a very effective fighting force. Now, the fact that it was possible to make a deal with this particular faction of the Taliban is also significant, because it is suggestive that it is possible to make deals. It's going to be difficult. It's not always going to be successful, but we had not had an example of a successful deal that was actually carried through. And to that extent, this is a positive signal.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. His books include The Shia Revival, Democracy in Iran, and his latest, now in paperback, is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. But one has to assume, I think, Vali Nasser, that Pakistan played a role in this, given how much the rumors, I think, are so prevalent that one has to assume that the ISI has had fairly intimate connections with the Haqqani network. And when you and Richard Holbrooke were trying to deal with this overall region, my understanding is that what frustrated you both was, one, that you couldn't deal on Kashmir, that was somehow taken off the table, so you couldn't deal with the bigger issue, which is India and Pakistan, the friction between them, in turn making it easier to deal with Pakistan. And in this case, my understanding is that there are now divisions within the Pakistani Taliban, and that the Pakistani government are now kind of having kind of buyer's remorse, if you will, about the extent to which they have supported the Taliban, because now they're worried about reverse sanctuary, that if the Taliban take over in Afghanistan, they may well be able to launch attacks from Afghanistan back into Pakistan. So is it let's start with that question. Is it true that the Pakistanis are having second thoughts about what they've wrought?
I don't think so. I think this is much more complicated than that. I think the Taliban actually have been very useful for America, for Pakistan's intelligence services in achieving their strategic objectives in Afghanistan. And Pakistan still has strategic objectives in Afghanistan. And therefore, I don't think they see the way in which they've deployed the Taliban in Afghanistan as having failed. Now, there has been blowback in Pakistan in terms of festering of Taliban within Pakistan, but I think Pakistanis treat that as a separate problem, and these are separate groups, and their targets are separate, and their objectives are separate. Now, I think what is a problem for Pakistan is that now that the United States is leaving the region, and it's not keeping the Taliban within Afghanistan busy with fighting, it would be more difficult for the Pakistanis to follow the policy that they had before, which was fight the Taliban at home and support the Taliban in Afghanistan as they fight the Americans. That's become much more difficult for them. So I think the Pakistanis have much better relationship with the Taliban that are fighting in Afghanistan, the Haqqanis included, than they have with the Taliban that are within their own territory. Now, whether the Pakistani Taliban will create a common front with the Afghan Taliban, it all depends on what kind of a policy the Pakistanis adopt against their own Taliban. They are currently debating whether they should take him on militarily or whether they should engage in negotiations with their own Taliban along the lines that we now see have happened in Qatar, which led to the release of Sergeant Bergdahl.
So in terms of, though, of a holistic deal, a broader deal for the region, which I understand you and Richard Holbrooke were tried to engage in the first place, is there any indication that, for example, the new leadership in India who've met with his Pakistani counterpart, is that possible? Because my understanding is that the Pakistanis are completely paranoid about India's influence in Afghanistan, and which I think they've largely exaggerated, but it is very much what's driving them, is it not, to want to control the future of Afghanistan?
Well, you know, we're in a world right now in which we think everybody has exaggerated strategic fears. Russia with Ukraine, China with the South China Sea and Japan, and, you know, the Pakistanis with Indian influence in Afghanistan. That may very well be the case, but these strategic fears are real, and they actually do animate countries' behaviors in ways that are very troubling to us. I mean, Ukraine is evidence of that. Now, you know, the Pakistanis do view an independent, strong, Pashtun-dominated Afghanistan as a natural ally of India in a strategic great game in South Asia. And there is historical reason for them to be actually worried. Now, I think there's always a scope for India and Pakistan to arrive at some kind of a agreement over Afghanistan and that would bring a certain degree of peace to the region. But with the United States' interest in South Asia declining, it's probably there's going to be less international support for this than was the case a few years back, because when we started with Richard Holbrooke in 2009, the United States was very interested in getting Afghanistan and getting Pakistan and India on the same page, because that would have created a much greater regional support, or at least regional common understanding around America's objectives in Afghanistan. Now that we are no longer engaged in the fighting in Afghanistan, we are no longer as motivated to facilitate a Pakistani-Indian understanding over Afghanistan. It's up to them to figure this out, whether it's in their own interest to do so or not. And I am generally not very hopeful that they will, largely because there is a lot of baggage between these two countries, and they do need some degree of outside assistance to allow them to get over some hurdles in their relationship. And that is not there. And the greatest fear is that now you have a powerful Hindu nationalist prime minister, and it's very tempting for extremists like the Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan to repeat an attack in India along the lines of the Mumbai attack, because that can very quickly escalate into a massive confrontation between these two countries. And I think what we might see going forward is as likely to be a case of confrontation as understanding between these two countries.
But isn't one of the ironies here that if this new Hindu nationalist government starts to indicate its extremist bent domestically, isn't it likely to sever one of the great sort of unities that country has? There's, I think the Muslim population of India is almost equal to that of the entire population of Pakistan. And if India, that would be the ultimate self-inflicted wound, wouldn't it, if India alienates its own Muslim population?
No, I think that population is to a larger extent alienated. And I think the fear is that the way Prime Minister Modi dealt with the Muslims in Gujarat was to put them in their place as a minority, and to assert Hindu nationalism's domination. And now he may not be eager to repeat that. He may have other priorities for India. But I think there is such a high level of expectation of him showing the iron fist. If Pakistani extremists or Pakistan in any way provoke India, that it's very difficult for him not to overreact. I think, his own background, his own constituency, the dynamic of internal Indian politics makes it very difficult for him not to react much more aggressively than the Congress party did in the face of the Mumbai attack. And that is exactly what is the incentive of extremist groups, knowing well that Modi is bound to and is likely to be pressured to react aggressively, not to provoke him. I mean, if the extremist game is to create a trouble in the region, then a provocation against India in the next year or so could very well achieve that goal.
Well, Osama bin Laden's provocation to George W. Bush certainly worked out that way, did it not? In the sense that...
Absolutely. I mean, the logic of terrorism, going back to the 1970s, Europe, Latin America, long before we arrived at 9/11, is to use shocking violence as a way of forcing a provocation that then translates into something much bigger. And the terrorists always end up in the process being decimated. But they have shown that a few people using shocking tactics can provoke much larger forces and into action that then find a logic of their own. So here you have two nuclear-powered countries deeply distrustful of one another. One of them, Pakistan, does have relationship with the extremists. But the extremists' own objective is not peace and prosperity, is not a common ground between India and Pakistan, but is a provocation of a much larger confrontation that they think in their own view of the world will benefit them. And therefore, now they might look at India and think that the situation is ripe, because you have a nationalist prime minister that's bound to respond much more aggressively. If he does so, then Pakistan will have to reciprocate. And then that puts South Asia in a very different plane. And I think Islamic extremists in South Asia very much like a polarized situation between Hindus and Muslims, between India and Pakistan, because they think it moves the political arena, the political discussion in their direction.
Well, just in closing then, Vali Nasser, back to the prisoner swap and objections coming from Republicans about the president's using the Emir of Qatar and making this deal where the Taliban, so-called high-value prisoners from Guantanamo, have got to stay in Qatar for a year. There's talk about how somehow the president's violated congressional prerogatives over Guantanamo. Are these likely to amount to anything?
Well, I think the criticisms of the president on this by the Republicans is misplaced. I think it would not have been good for the United States to be leaving Afghanistan and leaving behind a trump card in the hand of the Haqqani network. And I think it's important that as the United States is winding down its presence over there, that it doesn't leave any loose ends. Secondly, the Guantanamo prisoners are going to be under the custody of government of Qatar. I think, again, it is too much is made out of what the current value of these prisoners, even if you let them out after so many years, whether they would have any value more than symbolic to the constituencies they come from. And given that they're going to be under somebody else's prison instead of Guantanamo, they're still in prison. They're still not free. And I think the Taliban or the Haqqanis could not have freed an American. They could not arrive at a deal without being able to show that they got something for it. And this is as least as we could have given them for Sergeant Bergdahl. And I think it was largely a good deal for the United States.
Well, Vali Nasser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's good speaking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who is the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. His books include The Shia Revival, Democracy in Iran, and his latest, now in paperback, is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. We're going to take a brief station break and go to London to talk about why the left, who used to be champions of human rights and opposed to dictators, have more recently come to the defense of murderous regimes, often making excuses for Milosevic, Gaddafi, and Assad.
نازنی نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Mohammed Idris Ahmad, who is a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He is a lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts and co-edits pulsemedia.org and is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. His latest article at the LA Review of Books is A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mohammed Idris Ahmad.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And let's start with what's happening in Syria, or at least what we perhaps may be happening here. It's been pretty clear from the outset, in spite of a lot of what the political left have been saying about the U.S. Wanting to intervene in Syria as they did in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's been pretty clear that there's been a lot of ambivalence on the American side, that in fact the West in general knows what it doesn't want in Syria, but doesn't know what it really wants, whereas the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians know exactly what they want. And so far they've got what they want, and they're effectively winning, if anybody's winning in a situation where a country's being destroyed so that a dictator can maintain this kind of plantation control over this country that his family's had for 40 or 50 years. So there are indications that the U.S. may be stepping up activities with Jordan, carving out a kind of zone there around Dara on the border where the original uprising against Assad began. So do you think the Obama administration is having second thoughts?
Well, I think you summarized it very well. I mean, what's happening is that after 3 years, Obama administration has realized that its policy has been a disaster. And for the Syrians, especially, it's been a massive disaster. And what it has ended up with is that the major centers of resistance, especially in Homs and then also in Aleppo, so there the regime is gaining. And in fact, in Homs, it has been very much been able to reestablish its control. So what's happening in under those circumstances is that the Obama administration, which was not, as you pointed out, that which never knew what it wanted, but at the same time, the other side, the Russians and the Chinese, as well as the Iranians, so they are very certain about what the outcome that they want to see. So they back the regime fully. And the regime has military superiority, and it has been regaining control. And outcome of that is that right now, nearly 9 million people are displaced. And a lot of the people who are inside, they're internally displaced, and they're facing starvation. There are sieges going on. And as a result, these people have absolutely no hope at the moment. And it's not being helped that
at the same time, the Obama administration's commitment has always been to arm just barely enough so that they can resist. They can resist a complete takeover by the Assad regime, but not enough to grant the opposition victory because they have other concerns. They were very reluctant to give anti-aircraft weaponry because they were concerned that they might be turned on their ally Israel should it use its air force over Syria in the future. So these concerns, what they have made is that they've created a very paranoid policy, a sort of a schizophrenic policy, and in the end, it's not really helping that this policy is going to... It certainly isn't benefiting any party on the which is on the receiving end of the Assad regime's repression. So they are barely holding on, and their position is quite weak at the moment, and whatever aid that is being received even now, it's so minimal that it's not sufficient to turn the tide. So the absolute minimum is being done, and that's certainly not helping.
But what has happened is that Syria has become a magnet for jihadis who flocked in, often with the encouragement of Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, although now Saudi Arabia and Qatar are at odds over policies vis-a-vis Syria. And that's apparently...
Yeah, there is a misconception about that, that the jihadis who have come... on Turkish side, there was a certain degree of tolerance for foreign fighters who were coming in. But as regards the jihadis, they have their own networks. And so they are not reliant on any state. In fact, both the Saudis as well as the Turks have an interest not in encouraging any kind of jihadism because for them, the blowback can be more immediate, and especially the Saudis. But these people have their own networks. They have their own funding networks, and they also have their supply networks. So they are not really reliant on state so much as these networks of private donors across the Gulf mainly.
But what they have achieved is they've been a massive boon for Assad. They have,
of course,
driven so much of the population that were ambivalent into the embrace of Assad because they're afraid of these people, and quite understandably so. They've discredited the rebel movement in general and led people to make excuses for Assad.
Well, that's very, very true. What has happened is that there was a vacuum left because the nationalist opposition, so there was a resistance movement, and they had sort of come under the umbrella of the FSA, which was not exactly a single hierarchical organization, but it was a coalition of various...
And that's the Free Syrian Army, FSA.
Yes. So what happened is that they were starved of weapons. So, in fact, the main U.S. involvement there was that the CIA was stationed in southern Turkey to vet who the weapons that people were receiving from Qatar or Saudi Arabia, that who they might end up with, and which excluded a very large number of, in fact, the most effective groups within the FSA. So, in the end, stalled for weapons. They were not winning, and people usually support the winning side. And what has happened is that people started then flocking to the two main Islamist, the jihadist groups. One is the Jabhat al-Nusra, and the other one is the more extreme ISIS. And what has happened right now is the ISIS, which is more independent, and it's mainly foreign fighters, foreign jihadists. So they are the ones who have benefited most. And yes, there has almost been a tacit agreement with the regime. The regime very rarely attacks ISIS camps or their positions. And similarly, ISIS has been mainly fighting not the regime, but other rebel groups. And the territory that rebel groups liberate, so they soon after, then the ISIS steps in, and then they try to take control, and then they try to impose their own hardline laws over there.
So, again, I'm speaking with Mohammed Idris Ahmad, who's a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He's a lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts, co-edits pulsemedia.org, and is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. His latest article at the LA Review of Books is A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime revisionism. So let's get into that subject matter. Your article, of course, is about how Seymour Hersh is in the London Review of Books is still insisting that the chemical attack that took place a couple of years ago that led to this deal between the United States and Russia and Syria to get rid of Syria's chemical arsenal, which has largely been done, in my understanding. And that the whoever instigated that incident has been a matter of debate. But it's been pretty clear that it was from day one the Assad regime. What is the evidence that Tsai insists that he still has?
Well, his evidence is quite dubious because he only uses unnamed secret sources, and in this case, the story that he's retailing has been on the internet for quite some time. It was a conspiracy theory that started off on a Canadian conspiracy site called Global Research, and
that's that fellow with the Russian sounding name.
Yes, Michel Chusadovsky.
Yeah, he's a conspiracy theorist, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a pretty ludicrous. In fact, if you look at the original article from which the story was plagiarized, it's called. Not Tsai Hersh's story. He didn't plagiarize it, but his source, because there's a group of former intelligence and officers and diplomats who had plagiarized that story and published it as an open letter to Obama. But if you look at the original source, the headline of the article by a fellow called Yosef Bodansky is that was the White House behind the chemical attack in Syria, and it's conclusion is yes, of course. And so the thing is that it was a pretty ludicrous theory, which was started off which began at this conspiracy site from which it was picked up by this group of former intelligence officials.
Is that the VIPS?
VIPS. And what they did is that in the article, they claim that they have got all these sources in the Middle East who have told them this, except even that line itself in which they claim they have sources was also plagiarized from the original article. So if you read my article, you can see the plagiarized quotes from both of them, that how even down to the ellipses, they are in the exact places. So what happened is that story had been on the internet for quite some time. And Tsai Hersh first published a story in which he claimed that the Obama administration knew that the rebels were capable of producing sarin. And for that reason, he said that the Obama administration should have not laid the blame exclusively on the regime, but should have also considered blaming the rebels. Well, I mean, it was a very hedged argument, and fair enough, if there was such an evidence, except the evidence that he presents is just one news report that has once appeared that some rebel groups had tried to acquire some chemicals in Turkey. They were caught. But the initial story went around saying that they were trying to acquire sarin, except when what the evidence was looked at, it was just a list of rather everyday chemicals that these people were after. So it was a non-story, but he took it, and somebody has then spun something really big for him, his source, and he comes out with then a subsequent article. I mean, we won't be talking about this if it wasn't the name of Seymour Hersh and the London Review of Books, you know, both respectable names. So he comes out with then this really absurd conspiracy theory that the Turkish prime minister was personally involved in this attack, that he himself orchestrated it, and that these rebels, they somehow, I mean, he doesn't explain how, but they managed to take 1 ton of sarin into a besieged zone, I mean, a zone that is under the control of the government, and somehow even managed to rig a delivery mechanism, and somehow even managed to fire them in such a way that they appear to be coming from the regime-held areas. So the practicalities he doesn't go into. He just sends a nice conspiracy theory and says that the rebels could have done this, and his secret source told him that. And his secret source also told him that Erdogan, the Turkish prime minister, was personally involved. And in between, the practicalities are completely left out. So what I try to do with my article is to point out that how in every respect, from the practicality, from the logic to the evidence, all of the Seymour Hersh's article is bunk. So it lit the conspiracy sphere on fire, but it has absolutely no substance. And yet what it did is that it enabled the regime to continue, because people are reluctant. They think that somehow that story is it's still in, that the jury is somehow still out on that story, that we still don't know who did it, except we do. But according to Hersh, we don't. And people have taken comfort. There is this psychological comfort in not knowing. And because of that, they are unwilling to assign blame when new violations occur. The regime's atrocities are ongoing, and yet people are reluctant to blame because they think that somehow it's all in dispute.
Well, but the real story is so much at odds with that. I mean, I understand why a lot of people feel badly burned by Iraq in particular, not so much Afghanistan, but certainly Iraq, in the sense that the Bush administration lied their way into this war and conned everybody and trumped up a whole bunch of phony reasons for war and manufactured, the uranium hoax in Niger and all that stuff that Colin Powell addressed the UN with. So it's not, and I mean, the problem with conspiracy theorists is that they always, in the real world, intentions determine outcomes. Outcomes don't determine intentions. But if you take the latter and go to the outcome and then just trace back, you can make up the intention. You know, because the 9/11 tragedy led to Bush going to war, the assumption is that Bush arranged for that tragedy in order to go to war. And that's become the new groupthink on elements of the left, not the entire political left since then. And so you can understand that. But in the real world, my understanding is that Obama's been incredibly reluctant from day one to get involved, that Hillary Clinton, Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, and David Petraeus really leaned on him to arm the rebels, which he didn't do. And that what's really been going on is that Obama has a very close relationship with Putin, which is a big surprise to many people, that they talk regularly and often, and that Obama's focus is on the pivot to Russia and maintaining that relationship because it's far more important than some murderous little plantation owner in Syria. And that's what's really been governing it all. And,
Well, I think, first, the thing is that there's a comfort in conspiracy theories, because to know what happens in governments, it takes effort. And the day-to-day activities of governance and all of these things, they, in order to stay abreast of them, you have to put in a lot of time. And people take comfort in conspiracy theories because it explains the world without a person having to do any actual intellectual investment. And what has happened in the case of, for example, Iraq, I wrote a whole book about the Iraq War, so I know that what kind of deceptions were used and what an unprovoked war it was. But that in no way, because I spent a lot of time trying to understand how this came about and how, when especially the government was so reluctant, so many parts of the government were so reluctant that this war came about. Whereas in this case, the story is completely different, because in Iraq, there was no urgency to the situation. That's why the whole pretext had to be manufactured. I mean, Saddam Hussein wasn't out on a rampage at that time. His worst crimes were behind him by more than a decade. And nobody was even claiming that he's engaged in any kind of massacres or slaughters at that particular time. In fact, he was very much confined. Most of the deaths were indeed occurring because of the UN sanctions at the time. And then what we had, just simply the fact that the pretext then had to be invented. So it became the weapons of mass destruction and the conjunction with the involvement with terrorists, that if Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and if it hands them over to a terrorist, so they might do something. And that is an imminent threat. That's how the whole thing was sold. But the humanitarian pretexts were not even used until much after. But in Syria, we know we know day to day, I mean, not just from the U.S. government, but from a whole range of sources, independent sources, we know that atrocities are being committed daily. And that's something nobody disputes. So there is an urgency to the situation. So this is nothing like Iraq. And secondly, as you point out, that the U.S. has been anything but eager to go and intervene. In fact, even in Libya, if you remember, Obama was never gung-ho about it. In fact, he was dragged in with a lot of pressure from the British and the French governments. So same thing is true of Syria, because in Syria, U.S. doesn't have any interest at stake. So that's why there's a reluctance to commit troops. And that has, I mean, and also we know that Obama has generally been very reluctant to commit troops. I mean, the only first major escalation that he did in Afghanistan, we know the story of that because of Bob Woodward's work, that it came out of a great deal of pressure from the army, from Petraeus and others. But again, that was a temporary concession. But now what has happened is since then, he has been reluctant to commit any new troops. He's afraid of the political consequences at home, and especially in a place like Syria where there's no interest at stake. So why would he commit troops? So there was never an actual threat of a U.S. intervention. But that became a red herring for the political left, because what they used is that instead of worrying about the actual atrocities that are going on over there, they deflected attention. They made it the whole debate about this imminent threat of a U.S. invasion, which was actually never really being seriously considered. There was a very brief moment last September when it looked like the U.S. might do something, but that came and went. And yet this whole obsession with a supposed U.S. intervention has remained, and that has taken attention away from the actual atrocities that are happening day to day, and the perpetrator is well known. It's the Syrian regime.
Well, Mohammed Idris Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mohammed Idris Ahmed, who is a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He is a lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts, co-edits pulsemedia.org, and is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. His latest article at the LA Review of Books is A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Chinese government's official amnesia over the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, who's a professor of political science and East Asian languages and cultures at Indiana University, where he directs the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships. His books include The Business of Lobbying in China, China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization, and he's currently at work on two projects that focus on Chinese participation in international economic regimes and in placing the Chinese political economy in comparative perspective. His latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And there's been a fairly acrimonious exchange between the U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Lieutenant General Wang Guozhang, who's a deputy chief of the General Staff of the People's Liberation Army. They have been in Singapore, where they've been having the annual Shangri-La dialogue, where they're all supposed to get together, the military leaders of all the countries in the region and other leaders as well. But instead of this being a Shangri-La, it's turned into quite a nasty exchange with between the Chinese general and the U.S. Defense Secretary and the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. So is that an indication of how this relationship is getting rocky?
Absolutely. This is following on several months of some tense issues related to the South China Sea and the East China Sea, various border disputes. We're also at a politically sensitive time in China, given the upcoming anniversary of June 4th. And, you know, domestically, U.S. policy toward China and our overall foreign policy, the Obama administration has not done a very good job of articulating its vision or implementing it. And so a variety of different factors are probably what generated a lot of the heat and controversy in Singapore in the past few days.
Well, you have Chuck Hagel accusing China of destabilizing Asia. And then on the other side, you have the Chinese general accusing the U.S. and Japan of incitement. So it looks as though they're talking past each other.
Most definitely. They have very different views for what the Asia-Pacific should look like in terms of security architecture. You know, contrasted with Europe following World War II, where you had NATO, very clear, complex alliance structure. In East Asia, you basically had the United States at the center of an axis with relationships with Japan, the Philippines, Korea, but no institutionalized architecture. And as the Cold War wound down and China has become much more powerful, there's been no real institutionalized mechanisms in the region to deal with this changing balance of power in a way that would be relatively systematic. And the Shangri-La meeting is one of those areas where we do, but essentially these are all talk shops, and sometimes the talk, as you can see, can get quite heated.
So in terms of what has sparked this protest, we'll get to Tiananmen in a minute, but has sparked this protest in the South China Sea and this acrimony at the meeting in Singapore was the Chinese putting an oil rig in Vietnamese waters, and that led to protests in Vietnam and the burning of a lot of Chinese businesses, etc. China, of course, is incredibly energy hungry. So how much are we exaggerating their hegemonic? Because my understanding is that if they're hegemonic, they're more hegemonic in terms of the economy than they are in terms of the military.
Sure. I think you're absolutely right. But certainly China has ambitions to become the dominant power in Asia, including supplanting the U.S., who currently holds that role. But this is a long-term game the Chinese are playing. I think at the moment what they've been trying to do is, yes, they have long-term ambitions and believe the places where they've put that oil rig and the rest of the South China Sea is Chinese sovereign waters and territory, but that's obviously highly contested. And the relationship with Southeast Asia and elsewhere is being strained because they thought they had come to essentially an agreement where they wouldn't do anything provocative, and certainly the Chinese have done that. And I think probably what's got them doing that is one, you have a leader in Xi Jinping who's probably a little bit more nationalistic and a little bit more assertive than his predecessors. And two, you have the United States foreign policy establishment really unclear and ambiguous about what the U.S. role in the world is going forward, including in the Asia Pacific, where for the past few years they've announced that the U.S. is engaged in a pivot toward the region. Yet in the speech that President Obama gave at West Point last Wednesday, he barely mentioned China and Southeast Asia. He put them in the context of this hard to make sense of rules of the road part of his speech, but he didn't focus on the region specifically. And so I think the Chinese are testing the U.S. To see what their resolve is, and what they're finding is that the Obama administration is not very clear about really what is extremely important to them and what's not.
And Scott Kennedy, you were in China recently. What's your sense of what's going on with the Communist Party leadership in their crackdown, their preemptive crackdown on any possible dissent. They've been jailing scholars and activists and warning Western journalists to stay away from Tiananmen Square in the coming days.
Sure. Well, China's, as always, one of the most complicated places to understand, not only just because it's such a large country with a long history, but also there's so many different strands at any one moment. And at the same time that they are arresting folks and looking like they're on pins and needles, as well as, you know, putting more police in subways and issuing these warnings, it's also a place still, you know, surprisingly, despite all the headlines that this is accurately making, it's still a place of a tremendous dynamism where there's also big debates about the country's future, particularly on economic and social issues, where philanthropy, another area I've been paying a lot of attention to, has been growing really rapidly. And so at the same time that you're seeing all of this tension, you're seeing all of these other things as well. And so I think I don't think this is a regime worried about being toppled. I don't think that they're worried about a color revolution, but they are worried about substantial potential levels of violence directed against them, which they would find could spin out of control. I think they feel relatively secure in terms of overall popular support or the ability of the coercive apparatus to deal with those that aren't in favor of the regime. But at the tactical level, you're definitely seeing the screws turn quite severely.
And it seems to me that the Chinese communist regime, since Tiananmen, where, you know, those protests erupted over the death of Hu Yongbao, who was a very popular leader with the students, and because the President Zhao Zheng seemed to be more sympathetic to the students and give them a lot of rope, and, you know, they were able to go on television and basically harangue the leadership. This was unprecedented in China, and it just got to the point where the hardliners couldn't tolerate it anymore, and they cracked down in that brutal way. And ever since then, it seems like they've sort of substituted any democratic aspirations, particularly amongst the students, and replaced that by encouraging nationalism. Is that your reading on what's happened since?
I think that's certainly part of it. They have, I think, overall, the regime decided that if they had, at least the conservatives, thought that allowing the protesters to push toward regime change at that point would have led to a chaotic situation that may have created more freedom, but wouldn't have addressed China's other problems related to its economy and society and station in the world. And that is certainly an argument which they pull out again and again over the last 25 years to say, look, yes, we've kept things very tight politically, but compare us to any other regime, communist or otherwise, in terms of economic growth and development over that period, and you'll find that we've been relatively successful. Now, that's got a lot of value in that argument. It's not entirely wrong. At the same time, the reading of history is certainly shaped by their own preferences. At the same time, at sort of small types of democracy, which we're not talking about competitive elections for national office, but in terms of people's personal lives, their choice of career, their ability to travel. You know, 100 million Chinese traveled abroad last year. The amount of complexity in society and the development of NGOs and other types of things certainly is still continued. So again, it's a complex place in which, you know, in terms of big politics and big D, yes, nothing's changed and it's gotten tighter. But in terms of at the social level, still an immense amount of dynamism.
And of course, the Chinese have tried to thwart that because one of the main avenues for this dynamism has been the internet, which they've controlled in a way that's unprecedented. Certainly would be unprecedented over here. But looks as though Putin is borrowing from the Chinese model and doing what he can. He's pretty much taking control of the internet in Russia after having taken control of all of the media, except for one newspaper. And then they've just signed a deal. So is there any sense when you're in China that the Chinese are looking towards a sort of a compact with Russia and Iran, you know, kind of rejectionist compact against the American hegemon?
I think that we don't need to go too far down the road of thinking that we are returning to the type of relationship and pattern that we faced during the Cold War with the Soviets and Chinese on one side, with other smaller communist countries or rejectionists, and the U.S. and its allies on the other. Certainly there's elements of that, but the Chinese and Russians still have an extremely complex relationship and competitive in many ways. Deal that they signed, the 30-year deal they signed for natural gas last week, it was interesting that none of the details of that deal were announced, which suggests to me that they've not worked the details out. Even though the Russians clearly are borrowing from the Chinese playbook now on certain things, I don't expect us to be stepping toward the old Cold War style or even a hot one. There's many ways that the U.S. and China share common interests, not the least of which is economic. And so I think what we need is a much better diplomacy and foreign policy from our side to make sure that we don't go down the road which we seem to be heading, at least in the short term.
So we need to bring back Nixon and Kissinger, right?
Well, they probably do a little bit better than the current group. You know, I think the Obama administration actually started off on a pretty good foot in his first term, and they had a pretty clear idea of where China and Asia fit in the overall shape of their foreign policy. And in the last few years, despite what I think has been improved rhetoric about the need to pivot and refocus attention on Asia, in fact, it's been very minor. Yes, there's the push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership and greater discussion of security issues bilaterally and multilaterally. But really, it's really still unclear what our ultimate goals are and how our relationship with China is going to evolve over time. And in terms of day-to-day management, we just keep running into these headaches. And I think we just need greater focus and attention and clarity. And the speech that President Obama gave at West Point, I don't think did him well in laying out where we ought to be heading.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm happy to speak with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's a professor of political science and East Asian languages and cultures at Indiana University, where he directs the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has his books include The Business of Lobbying in China, China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.